Walters, J. Tracy Walker, Ford, Edward, and Bondurant, Christopher D. Spencer, Collins Council, Donnie, Lishinsky, Gregory L. Lyon, Joanna M. Meyer, E. Kyle McNew, T. Brent Brown, William A. Jennings, Daniel L. Crandall, here at Appalachian Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Tracy Walker, on behalf of the appellants, I would like to reserve 6 minutes of my time if time allows.
Did you say six?
Six, Your Honor. This case arises out of a 2006 rollover crash of a 1995 Mazda Miata convertible in which the plaintiff below, Mrs. Walters, sustained serious injuries. She contended at trial that the latches holding the rag top on the vehicle to the windshield header had a defect, that they became disconnected because of that defect, and that there was a resultant increase in the deformation to the windshield header that caused her injury. To get to a jury, Walters had to establish that the Miata was unreasonably dangerous either for the use to which it was put or some other reasonably foreseeable purpose. And, of course, she had to show that the alleged defect was the proximate cause of her injury. This case should not have gone to the jury on her theory. There was no evidence that the reasonably foreseeable purpose of the soft top or its latches was to stay connected in a crash or to provide protection in a rollover.
May I ask you this? Are there any cases in modern American tort law where ragtop convertibles were held to not be crash-worthy because of rollover risk?
I'm not aware of any case in Virginia, and I have not searched outside of Virginia. In the Driesenstock case, which we cite, I believe, in our opening brief, there is a reference made, and that's a federal case, there is a reference made to convertibles as an example of not having that purpose. That would be an example of where you wouldn't hold a manufacturer of a convertible liable for not providing that protection.
So the threshold question appears to be that, I mean, crashworthiness was a judicial doctrine sort of pasted onto existing tort law and UCC law. You know, is there a crashworthiness duty at all when you're trying to protect against rollover risks involving a convertible with a soft top?
Well, I would argue ultimately that there is no duty there. This court in the Sloan case said that this court will address the crashworthiness doctrine that other courts have specifically adopted under general principles of Virginia law, but I think you get to the same place, and I think it falls directly under this court's holding in Gelblin v. Gamble, in which you had a finding in a jury trial of defect in latches of a window screen. So there was a finding of defect, but this court said, before we get to defect, and we have to look at duty. And foreseeability is cabined by duty, and it was not the foreseeable purpose of a window screen to protect against a child falling out of a window, even if there was a defect in the latches.
So the threshold question in this case is there, under Virginia products liability law, a foreseeable duty to construct either the latches or any other component of a soft top convertible to protect passengers and the driver in a rollover situation? That seems rather extenuated to me in terms of applying crashworthiness.
We would argue that there is no such duty, and there was no evidence at trial supporting such a duty. There was no evidence that car manufacturers generally design vehicles with that in mind. There was no engineering literature supporting the notion that that's how convertibles are designed.
What about the testimony of the expert that manufacturers want these components to stay connected in the event of a crash?
That was the extent of his testimony, that you want something.
But he has 40 years in the industry, et cetera. Does that count for nothing?
It does not legally count for anything, because simply wanting a desired outcome. Certainly, I would think the screen manufacturer in the Geldwin case would have wanted the screen to stay in the window and for the child not to have fallen out, a tragic thing to have happened. But that doesn't make it a reasonably foreseeable use.
Now, counsel, your opposing counsel distinguishes the Geldwin case in terms of the expectations that one would have.
I think the expectations are nearly identical. There was a concession in the Geldwin Gamble case that the ordinary use of a screen is to keep bugs from coming in, but to allow air to flow in. Mrs. Walters and her mother-in-law, who purchased the vehicle, essentially made this same concession. They understood that the purpose of a soft top or a rag top is to keep the temperature confined within the vehicle, to keep the wind out, to keep the rain out. That was what they understood the purpose of it was, and they affirmatively said that before this lawsuit was filed, they had no expectation that the top would provide them protection in a rollover.
Now, counsel, also to follow up on Justice McCullough's question, unless we strike expert witness Mundo's testimony, then the jury is permitted to, it essentially becomes a battle of the experts, does it not? Where the jury can consider his conclusions or can consider your expert's conclusions?
Well, there are two answers to that. I think this court should strike Mr. Mundo's testimony because he had no facts to support his assumptions, but there is also a sufficiency question that this court can rule directly on, that there was insufficient evidence to support the plaintiff under their theory. And getting back to Geldwin v. Gamble, this court ruled as a matter of law and reversed a jury without throwing out an expert opinion and just said that's not the foreseeable.
Well, duty is a question of law. Duty is not something juries decide. We don't give jury instructions. Do you think there's a duty? We give instructions that tell them what the duty is and apply the facts to it.
And it is our position that there was no duty here, and there was nothing that showed that there was.
May I switch gears for a moment, though, to causation, which appears to be a narrower ground than the one we're talking about. Is there any evidence here that the injury occurred before or after the dislodging of the latch?
No, sir. The testimony from Dr. Bolinson was very specific, and I believe it is at pages 1093 through 94, that he did not know when the injury occurred, and furthermore, he did not know how much movement of the head or neck was necessary to cause the injury. And then he was asked, well, how much deformation of the windshield header would have had to have been avoided to prevent the injury, and he did not know that.
Let me pause you there for a second. Then what am I missing? That sounds like, on its face, but for causation, putting even aside proximate causation, but for causation doesn't exist here.
That would be our position because, again, absolutely, we agree with you because Mr. Mundo said that deformation does occur. His quote was he had seen it many times at page 937. Even with a hardtop sedan, even with a convertible, if the latches stay connected, even, you know, however you do it, he says, yeah, you see deformation in rollover crashes.
So to prove causation here, they would have to show the dislodging, the disconnection occurred before the injury, otherwise this whole debate is moot. And secondly, that had it occurred before the injury would not have happened or would have been lessened. I don't see that anywhere in this.
We agree. And there was nothing from Mr. Mundo about the incremental increase in deformation that resulted from the latches disconnected.
What inferences could a jury properly draw from the laceration on her head?
The only inference I think they could draw from that is that her head hit something in this rollover crash. There were many things it could have hit in the crash, whether it was the windshield header or the ground or the top of the soft top, so I don't believe they could draw any reasonable inference. There was testimony from Mrs. Walters and from a witness that she was actually found with her head at the back of the vehicle. And we don't believe there are facts sufficient to infer that the injury was even caused by the windshield header, but I think Justice Kelsey's point is the stronger one for us, that under their theory of the case, let's assume that it was caused by the windshield header pushing down. That could have happened before the lashes came undone, and Mr. Mundo never said when they came undone. So he said you can get deformation. So we think they have not fulfilled their burden of proof on that point. And then the other point,
Scientist, the athlete's theory of the case, they're going to argue, as they have on brief, that you're focusing on the roof and they're focusing on the latches. That if the latch had not come undone, then this damage would not have occurred. What is your argument with regard to whether there was a duty to design a latch that would not come undone?
Certainly. And of course, the latches didn't cause the injury. Their theory is that the windshield header, which is part of the roof, caused the injury. But there was no evidence, just like there was no evidence that a convertible in toto is not required to provide occupant protection, there was no specific evidence that latches are supposed to provide protection beyond Mr. Mundo's statement that was not supported, that you want latches to stay connected. There was no evidence brought in that of any design or performance standard of any manufacturer or any industry group or the government as to how latches are to be designed, how strong they have to be. Appellees say a number of times in their brief, I believe at least seven, that it was required in the industry that latches have a very specific pin and hole connection with a straight line. But there was no evidence of that at trial. The jury was not shown any evidence of how other manufacturers design latches at all, with one exception, that being the Mustang latch, which Mr. Mundo did show to the jury. But then Mr. Mundo said, I don't know how the Mustang latch would perform. I don't know if it is reasonably safe. I'm not pointing to it as a go-to latch. So under the evidence that was presented to this jury, it was equally probable that the Miata latch would perform better in a crash than the Mustang latch, because Mr. Mundo backed away and said, I'm not saying anything about this Mustang latch. So the jury was not given anything to judge that this latch, and we did address the latch, not just the vehicle, that this latch was unreasonably dangerous. And so, again, there was no proof of defect there. No proof that any other latch would have performed differently. No evidence that the Miata latches have not performed well in other crashes. None of the types of evidence that you would see in these types of cases. And as to the purpose point, I think the federal agency that governs the safety of vehicles does have a rollover protection standard, and it's phrased in terms of the whole roof, not just the latch. But it has a test that limits the deformation to 5 inches. But the federal government said, we're going to exempt convertible vehicles because we don't think it's practical for convertible vehicles to provide this type of protection. And that exemption, in effect, creates the custom in the industry. They don't design them that way because it's not practical to do so. So under Turner v. Manning, in that case, it was for a hoist fail. It could have had a safety hook. There was an acknowledgement that safety hooks were used, but it was also acknowledged that, or the evidence was that it was not the custom in the industry to have safety hooks. Here, it's not the custom in the industry for convertibles or their latches to provide this protection. That's controlling. Mr. Mundo never came in and said, well, the federal standard should be extended more broadly to convertible vehicles. So in this case,
or that industry has surpassed and leapfrogged the government standard.
Correct. There was no evidence of that. And I'll close with Mr. Mundo. I believe this case falls squarely in this court's opinion in Hyundai v. Duncan. Mr. Mundo looked at the vehicle. He observed the vehicle, and he declared it defective. He said the crash speaks for itself. We're not trying to hold Walters in this case, and we're not advocating for a rule, and broadly in all cases, that certain types of testing have to be done in product liability cases. But you have to do something when you assume that a design is not robust enough. You can't just come in and say, I don't think it's strong enough. I looked at it. I don't think it's strong enough. This court has consistently said you have to back up your opinions with facts and analyses. And there are any number of analyses that he could have done. He said, in the ordinary course, he would have done a computer analysis to determine if a design is reasonably safe. He didn't do a computer analysis here. We would rely on our briefs for the other evidentiary points, and I would reserve the rest of my time for the vote.
May it please the court. I'm John Lichtenstein. I represent Shannon Walters, the appellee. In this case, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Ms. Walters in both breach of implied warranty and negligence. And the trial judge, very thoughtfully over a period of deliberate consideration, entered judgment on that verdict. I suggest to your honors there is a good reason for that, and it lives inside the deep factual record of this case. That fact gives evidence to these findings and to this verdict, and it should be respectfully affirmed. The evidence in the case from Mr. Mundo, and I'll jump to that immediately, was that when he came to school in his engineering education, he learned that in the design of automotive latches, engineering principles required that automotive latches hold in three cardinal directions. It was symbolized by a rule called the right-hand rule in engineering parlance. They must hold side to side, front to back, and up and down. So the rule had the fingers that went like this.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We've read that, of course, and it's a great point, but can you address this question? What evidence shows by a preponderance that the injury occurred either before or after the latch is disconnected?
The evidence that the eyewitness found Ms. Walters hanging from her seatbelt. She had not hit the ground. He testified to the jury that he had to hold her, cut the belt, and gently lower her to the ground, to the roof that was on the ground. There
so
was not.
The jury can infer from that 51% likelihood that the injury occurred to her head after the dislodgement? That's the whole basis for the causation?
The jury, Justice Kelsey, could reach the conclusion, and rationally so, that the windshield header, which had become disconnected because of the latch failure, and come down. Mr. Evans said it was flat in line with the hood and invaded the passenger space, consistent with the laceration on radiology that Dr. Brolinson cited, had pushed her head down, and that it was indeed the rollover that had done that.
But how do we not know that the header and the windshield crushed, hit her head, and then a second afterwards the latch busted and it flopped open?
Well, we do not. The jury was within its rights. We submit to Your Honor.
Okay, I'm with you on that, and I honestly believe that strongly, as you do, but I'm trying to get a hold of some fact that would make that inference something other than a guess, which it appears to be to me. I'll just lay it out on the table.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that. It is not a guess for this reason. It was known, at least by factual evidence from the eyewitness, that all of this was true. The vehicle was resting on its roof. The roof was built of three steel cross beams. This roof was stronger than the sheet metal on a sedan. That was the evidence. The roof was connected in the back to the structure. The evidence from Mr. Mundo was, and this is the engineering principle at work. I'm coming back to the evidence that Your Honor is asking for. But the engineering principle at work in this case, the basic engineering principle of decades and decades old when he started school 50 years ago, was that it is the connections of the vehicle structure that matter. This was not a convertible in this use. This was a closed-roof configuration. Mazda designed, manufactured, and sold a dual-use product. In the closed-roof configuration, this isn't a rag top. This isn't a soft top. This isn't a roof that failed. When Mr. Evans gets there, this roof is holding up the vehicle. The latch on the door has functioned correctly. It's locked. It didn't spring open like the latch that held the windshield to the roof itself. And so what happens is that all of this comes together in this setting. And, Your Honor, we come back to the proximate cause issue. It is not a question of proving chronologically, step by step by step by step, here's when this happened, here's when that happened.
Actually, I think it is. I think that's the way causation works.
Well,
sequential.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, but the step by step that is proved is sufficient for the jury in the inference that we are entitled to on this evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Walters. The jury is entitled, when the evidence from the eyewitness was that the connections had failed, that it was disconnected, and that the windshield frame, which is not part of the roof, with all due respect, The windshield frame is the windshield, and it had separated the central safety purpose, unlike Geldwin, of this case and this latch, is the prevention of unsupported, disconnected structure that invades the passenger space. That's the central safety purpose of this latch. And it has an express safety purpose. The plaintiff's expert in Geldwin conceded there was no safety purpose for that screen. But, Your Honor, with respect to the proximate cause, if the jury reached the conclusion, as Dr. Brolinson testified to and was qualified to do, that in fact what happened is that this latch separated, not because of force. Both sides agree that this was not forcible parting. It separated because of the absence of a straight line design feature, like a deadbolt, that would hold in a vertical motion. Instead, it was a rounded nub and a rounded recess, no traction, and the jury saw over and over that, in fact, it could not hold in vertical movement. If the jury reached the conclusion that what happened in the case was that the vehicle rolled over, she was, the contest on this point that the defense put in, Justice Kelsey, was a diving injury. They said the way this happened was she hit the ground, and she hit the ground before, and that's what happened here, and that's why she's paralyzed.
But they don't have to prove anything. They're just a defense. You're the party with the burden of proof.
Understand. But at the time that came in for the jury hearing these facts, if the jury reached the conclusion on the expert testimony as given by Dr. Brolinson that this vehicle rolling in its one-half turn and this latch which separated because it couldn't hold in a vertical direction, vertical movement, and that windshield, therefore, was unsupported. When it rolled over, Your Honor, and it hit, that windshield collapsed on her head. That is consistent.
Do we know when the latch disconnected?
Before or after the injury? The latch had to disconnect before that windshield collapsed. It was because the latch disconnected that windshield collapsed.
Who said that?
Mr. Mundo.
He said that the windshield deformity would not have occurred in the absence of a dislodged latch?
Absolutely correct.
What page did he say that on?
I'll get it later. It is somewhere in the 830s, 40s, 50s, and I'll find it. Sure. He also, Your Honor, went to the point where he said, further, if you look at the back of the roof structure, the back of the roof structure remained connected, unlike the latch. And because it was connected, it was supported, which is the scientific principle at work, the evidence at work, and it did not collapse. That's how the so-called ragtop held up this vehicle. And that's how Mr. Evans was able to crawl in and hold her and cut her. She had never hit the ground. Mr. Mundo testified point blank that this had to happen that way. He said in his quote, well, there's only one way in the world this could happen. So Mr. Mundo and Mr. Rice each agreed that the latch had come separated because that's the only way that windshield can deform down in this. Can there be deformation if you drop it off a building? Yes. Can there be deformation in other settings? But in this case, he said the reason there was deformation was because the reason the windshield collapsed was because it became disconnected. And it became disconnected first, before it collapsed and invaded the passenger space. That's the order of things. Dr. Brolinson then conducted his own separate examination, including the scene, including the vehicle, including the collapsed windshield, and reached the conclusion, consistent with the laceration on the top of Ms. Walter's head, that she had been pushed into a pathological deflection beyond the point where any neck could hold. The ligaments tore, and the vertebra shifted into her spinal cord.
How much deformation would have occurred if there had been no latch disconnection whatsoever?
How much of that is not knowable? It is not knowable to say if these latches, but the one thing Mr. Mundo said,
if we don't know, how do we prove but-for causation?
Well, the way that Mr. Mundo testified to it is if this latch had not disconnected, this windshield would have remained supported and would not have collapsed, and therefore invaded Ms. Walter's space. That's the core. Now, that's his testimony. That's the sequential order of proximate cause in this case. It's a basic case. It's a latch. It's not an electronic sensor. It's not a complicated machine.
Let me ask you this. In this particular case, is it your theory that the collapse of, or that the fact that the integrity of the compartment was compromised was the cause, or was it the disconnection that was the cause? So, and that's, I think that follows Justice Kelsey's question.
It does.
I'm confused as to that.
So I appreciate that question. It is the latter. The testimony of the expert was that it is the connection of the vehicle structure that holds it together and gives it the safety, accomplishes the safety purpose of preventing it from becoming unsupported if the connection, whether it's a latch, a bolt, or a well, doesn't hold. It is the connection coming apart. His testimony was that when this latch, which was not properly designed with a straight line deadbolt connection, visible, should have been rejected for that reason. But when it came apart, Justice Mims, the evidence was from Mr. Munden that at that point the windshield became an unsupported cantilever. He said at that point there is no support for the windshield. When the windshield then rolled over, when the vehicle rolled over, the windshield would have been supported by the rest of the structure, which is why the connections are so important, collapsed and invaded Ms. Walter's face. Mr. Evans said flat on her side.
Is it your theory, though, that the windshield caused the laceration, or is it your theory that the front leading edge of the soft top that caused the...
The windshield and only the windshield. The roof did not collapse. Exhibit 1 in this case is a picture of the roof. It didn't collapse. It's 3 steel cross beams connected to the structure, and it held this vehicle up.
So it's the top edge of the windshield itself.
It's the windshield frame. When you're sitting in the car, this is the frame. This part came in because the latches that otherwise connected it to the structure, this jury heard the engineering evidence, failed.
Okay. Thank you.
Because of the
thank
deep.
Okay. In addition to
and
that.
Thank you for that question.
Okay. So where in the joint appendix does Mundo testify when the latch is disconnected and when she was injured? Where are those?
Mr. Mundo testified to the order that I described. Now, he didn't give a time. He said that the step-by-step.
Well, doesn't matter. Doesn't time matter for causation?
Well, if the order given gives the time, gives the sequential step, then that's sufficient. And the jury had what it had to make a rational decision. What he testified to, Your Honor, is that this separation occurred first. The collapse of the windshield occurred because it was no longer connected to the structure. And when the vehicle rolled over, the windshield collapsed and came down on Mrs.
So the deformation on the driver's side was, what, 1.9 inches?
Well, the deformation was nearly flat on the driver's side, according to the independent eyewitness who viewed it himself. There was a photometric analysis, so-called photometric analysis. After it was all over, they pulled the car back over, and the defense conducted a photometric analysis and said it was X number of inches. Mr. Rice testified, the Mazda expert, that there would have been rebound, that once it comes back up, that windshield comes back up.
So if there had been the latch that hadn't disconnected at all, did the expert say there would have been no deformation that could have caused this injury?
He testified that this injury, we wouldn't have been here, is the way he put it. This would not have happened. Mr. Mundo testified that, in fact, if the connection held, and this is the basic of the long-held engineering principle, if the connection held, that windshield is supported like the rest of the structure.
So you turn the Mazda upside down, drop it on the roof, and a soft top with a good latch is going to keep any deformation of the windshield? That's his expert testimony?
No, sir. He is not saying that if you drop it off a building...
You flip it over on its top. The windshield is going to stay completely undeformed if a rag top has its latches at hold.
Well, in a case where there remains a connection to the structure, his testimony was it would have performed like the back of the structure performed, which had not become disconnected. I mean, let me say it this way, and this is what I think, and I know I'd like to reserve about 20 minutes and come back afterwards if that's possible, but I know it's not. The one thing that I would say is we are having this conversation, and this conversation is about a so-called ragtop. And we're talking about how you can't do this with a convertible. I appreciate the Dreisenstock case, but Dreisenstock was not a dual-use product. If you open up this roof, it's a convertible. And if it turns over, so be it. Those load paths aren't there. Mr. Mundo acknowledged that and said that. But when you sell a vehicle that's a sedan that is latched and a structure that is like other vehicles, and you put steel crossbeams across this roof, the central miracle, and it's not a miracle, the central mechanical truth of this case is that the roof held up the vehicle. It's not a ragtop. It's a strong roof. These were hefty steel latches.
Counselor, you're starting to run out of time. We've spent 16 minutes on causation and none on duty. One of the arguments of opposing counsel is that there's an irony here, and that is that if in fact this was a convertible, that you would have had that same amount of crush. So that, in other words, there is that you are arguing for an enhanced duty because the top was up than if the top was down. And yet there's no testimony that where she said, oh, I always had the top up because I always wanted it to be as safe as possible. So where does the duty arise in the first place, and is it possible to have a bifurcated duty? Because that's essentially what has to be argued.
Yes, sir. And ultimately, the duty when the vehicle is being operated in its closed roof configuration, the duty is the same as it is in any other vehicle. It is to make the vehicle reasonably safe for its intended and foreseeable purpose. That's what the duty is. Mr. Mundo testified that there is nothing unique about this latch mechanism connecting the windshield frame to the forward roof structure. It's just like other aspects of the structure that are partly latches, like the doors. Hatchbacks have latches, doors have latches, these doors function, those latches function. Welds, bolts. The jury heard and accepted that evidence. The jury heard and accepted that when this vehicle is driven and this roof is up, it's covered by three steel crossbeams. Everything was strong enough. Mr. Rice said the latch was strong enough, and Mr. Rice said, as Mr. Mundo has said, the latch didn't come apart because it was forced apart. There was no forcible parting. That's at 1350. Some of these will come back. But the jury heard that and reached the conclusion that Mr. Mundo's testimony about the defect and the proximate causation of that defect made sense in the case because the lack of the rod and straight line connection into the hole, the nub and the recess, both 100% chamfered and rounded, did not hold in the vertical direction of a rollover, 243,000 rollovers. So, Your Honor, I think, and I'm going outside, but the duty to make a vehicle when you sell it with the product of using the vehicle with the roof closed, if we came in, I don't know what year it might have been, but if we came in and the evidence was that this thing turns over, doesn't matter if the top's up or the top's down, different case. But that's not the evidence in this record.
The evidence is that there was a 5-inch movement, right? I mean, it was less than 5. It was, what was the measurement? It was way less than 5 inches. The federal reg is 5 inches.
Of the roof.
For a non-convertible.
Right. But that's a setting where if the roof is what had caused the injury, if the roof had become deformed, that would be relevant. Standard 216, with all due respect, it's not that it's not relevant to convertibles with the top open. It's that this roof was closed and latched, and the evidence throughout Mr. Mundo's testimony, much of which was never refuted. Mr. Rice never refuted the engineering science of three cardinal directions for the latch. So, my hope is that I can show you there was a sequence, Justice Kelsey, as you're asking on causation, absolute sequence. And the jury was proper to And I do believe in it, but the jury was proper to make that reliability and credibility determination in this setting because that sequence is consistent with proximate cause. And Justice McClanahan, the roof didn't cause the injury. The roof never collapsed. What happened was a defective latch didn't stay latched. This latch was defectively designed, didn't work. And because of that, the windshield frame, not the roof, the windshield frame became disconnected from the other structure of the vehicle and collapsed, invaded the passenger space, and paralyzed Ms. Walters at 26 years old. She was pushed down by the windshield frame, not the roof. So it is a red herring, Federal Safety Standard 216. No federal standard controlled this case. The education, training, 40-year experience of Mr. Mundo was appropriate, facts known to him, not speculative, buttressed by Mr. Evans, buttressed by Ms. Walters, buttressed by the fact that this independent witness saw the car on its roof, the roof not collapsed, the rear of the roof structure held, consistent with Mr. Mundo's theory. This
has he answered your question, Justice McClanahan?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
Judge, thank you.
Your time has expired.
Briefly, Your Honors, a couple of points in rebuttal. First, there was a discussion of a requirement of a straight line deadbolt connection. Again, there was no evidence of that at trial. That does appear in the brief. Mr. Mundo testified, for example, at page 844, that a pin and hole connection is just one example of the easiest way to design a latch. But he said there could be other ways to design latches and never specified that the industry has adopted a particular way to design latches. Mr. Mundo also explained that the windshield frame, the windshield header, is part of the roof. It is the structural component. If you have a hardtop sedan, it is the frontmost structure at the front of the roof. And when the ragtop is connected, it is the structure. But that is what Mr. Mundo explained, that it is the supporting device. And in our reply brief, we did a link to the diagram in the federal standard that shows that in the federal test, the test actually pushes on the windshield header, which is the very thing that allegedly caused the injury. We believe that timing is important, and we believe it's very important because Mr. Mundo did testify at page 937 and I believe at 899 that you do expect deformation to occur with hardtop sedans, with convertible vehicles, with the roof up.
Do you lose that point under the standard of review? That is, we look at the evidence in light most favorable to the prevailing party, and there's this testimony about the bounce back and how it was looking at the time. So applying that standard of review filter, does that mean we really can't consider that point?
Justice McCullough, we don't believe you do at all because we think that Atrium Unit Owners Association and Wells v. Whitaker, where there was an issue of timing, of whether improperly stored primacord or sodium nitrate, which exploded first. When there is not evidence to show the timing, it is a matter of speculation for a jury, and under this court's standard of care, you have
and to. My question was directed specifically at the extent of the deformation in the testing that Mazda did in that connection.
Well, Mazda, there was no evidence in this case that Mazda did any testing. Oh, the measurements.
The measurements.
Okay, the measurements that were done by Mr. Germain. He testified, and I could give the pages of his testimony. It is at pages 1405 through 1409. He did those measurements through a photographic analysis of the vehicle up in its upside-down configuration before it had been turned over. So that he came up with 2 to 4 inches before the vehicle had even been moved, which was less than the federal standard, if the federal standard applied. So Mr. Mundo just glossed over everything and said, it collapses. He didn't do what an engineer would do and say, well, it moved 1 inch before the latch is disconnected at 2 inches after. He just tried to gloss over all of it.
Well, pardon my confusion, but it seems that their theory is not that there was a degradation of the compartment, a collapse of the compartment. The theory is that because of the disconnection, that when it degraded within what would have been the federal standard, if federal standard applied, that it pushed her head forward, and that if it had not disconnected, that would not have happened. In other words, this was not a crush injury that would have happened like with a Corvair or something turning over 50 years ago. But this was, in fact, because there's now a free object that should not have been a free object. Respond to that, if you would.
I don't understand it quite that way, but I think I understand your confusion. I think their theory, Your Honor, was that there was excessive intrusion of something, the windshield header, that pushed down on her head. Now, Mr. Mundo did explain that it was acting like a cantilever, but their theory was excessive intrusion of that member, that structural member, which is part of the roof structure. It is the top. If the rag top is connected, or if it's a sedan, it is that member that goes across. Their theory was it came in too much. But they admitted it would come in even if the latches had stayed connected. They never said how much incremental deformation there was.
Well, for that matter, we had a difference of views presented here today as to whether or not there was any evidence that the injury occurred after the latch disconnection as opposed to before. What is the simple answer to that? Did anybody say, look, in my expert opinion, I can show you the sequence. The disconnection of the latch occurred before the injury. Because if it occurred a millisecond after the injury, this falls under basic Paul's graph. There's no causation at all.
There was no evidence, Your Honor, and that was the point of our appeal. There was no evidence that it occurred after the latch is disconnected.
So there's no evidence that the header collapsed because the latch malfunctioned?
There was evidence that the latches became disconnected. We don't believe Mr. Mundo offered any support for his opinion that it had anything to do with whether the pins were long enough or the holes were deep enough. But I understood Justice Kelsey's question to be as to when did they disconnect. Mr. Mundo didn't answer when they disconnected. He just said that at some point in the crash they disconnected, and Dr. Bowen said, I don't know when the injury occurred.
I guess I want to know why they disconnected, because it's my understanding that there's testimony that the header disconnected because the latch failed. Is there testimony to support that?
There is not testimony that supports that conclusion. Mr. Mundo did say that he didn't think the design was robust enough in the up and down direction for the latches to stay connected. But another assignment of error of ours is he never provided the court with any explanation of why. And there was essentially in the argument that was just made, it's yet another assignment of error, but the statement was made to this court that the jury saw over and over that the latches could come undone with this vertical movement. That was the in-court exercise where they had been removed and were not bolted in and did not have the properties that they would have when they were bolted into the vehicle. There was no evidence to show that these latches would come undone at any specific time, and they could well have come undone. That could have been the very last thing that happened, that the windshield header moved down. He did say it took up and down vertical movement. The windshield header moves down, she gets injured, and then as that downward movement comes to a stop, the latches let go, and the eyewitness then finds her there.
Well, isn't this his conclusion at J872? Because the issue at hand is that the joints were not connected and there was no damage to the devices that were doing the connecting, and the crash spoke for itself. There it is. It's not connected.
Right. It was the ultimate conclusion. He observed it and said, And this court has consistently said that just saying the crash speaks for itself, it must have been defective, it must have been the proximate cause, is not enough. So we would respectfully ask that this court reverse and enter the final judgment.
And Mr. Walker, Mr. Lichtenstein, the court thanks you both for excellent arguments. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.